Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And now we continue our midterm election series, 30 issues in 30 days, everything except Russia, as we keep our eye off the scandals and on the policies of the Trump administration and Congress, not scandals and personalities, to help inform your midterm votes. Next week, we'll begin looking at what Democrats are proposing regarding major issues if they do get into power in Congress. Today, we conclude our 10-part debate series on things that Trump and this Republican Congress have actually done. Our topic today, climate change. On yesterday's show, if you were listening, we talked about the new report compiled as part of the Paris Climate Treaty process that concluded there will be much more dire effects than previously believed from the likely rise of just one more degree Fahrenheit by the year 2040. They say they previously assumed that one more degree Fahrenheit of warming would not be catastrophic. But now that they've taken a closer look at 6,000 studies, they believe that by 2040, droughts and therefore poverty will be worse. Many coastal areas will be inundated, including major population centers from the U.S. to China to Japan to the Philippines to Egypt to India and others. If we go up another 2 degrees, all coral reefs would be destroyed, according to the report. And the 1 degree rise by 2040, if we can't stave it off, would cost the global economy $54 trillion, says the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. President Trump's reaction was to say the climate might actually be fabulous.
It was given to me. It was given to me. And I want to look at who drew it, you know, which group drew it, because I couldn't give you reports that are fabulous, and I can give you reports that aren't so good. But I will be looking at it, absolutely. What do you think
about— Now, withdrawing from the Paris Accords, which Trump has begun a process to do, and casting doubt on climate science, as we heard there, were core components of how Trump sought to get elected, such as the time in April 2016 when he wished out loud for more global warming at a rally upstate in Rochester.
Speaking of global warming, where is we need some global warming? It's freezing. Man. In fact, this is a record cold spell on the whole big section of the United States. It's not just Rochester. The whole big section is like record cold. And I keep hearing about global warming. Now they'll say, he doesn't understand. This is a worldwide problem. Oh, no, I don't understand. Let's do IQ tests. So, these people.
Cheers for science denial in 2016, an example of his rhetoric on the issue and the crowd's response. And here's how polarized the politics and the language of this are, from Trump's sarcasm there to existential doom. Here's Bernie Sanders campaigning from a 2016 Democratic primary debate.
The planet that we're going to leave our children may not be healthy and habitable. This is a crisis we have got to deal with now.
Bernie Sanders in 2016. And here's Mayor de Blasio from a 2015 conference at the Vatican that was called Modern Slavery and Climate Change.
Is it not the definition of insanity to propagate governmental policies and consumer habits that hasten the destruction of the earth and yet somehow expect some other result?
So we have Trump sarcasm and climate fabulism on the one side, inhabitability and destruction of the earth, Bernie Sanders and Bill de Blasio's words, on the other. As for actual policies, besides starting the process for withdrawing from the Paris Treaty, the Trump administration has increased the amount of allowable auto emissions and replaced the Obama administration's clean power plan, which required states to meet certain carbon emission limits. According to Time magazine, that would have been done largely through transitioning from coal to natural gas for energy production and would have cut carbon emissions by 32%. Time cites an EPA analysis of Trump's replacement plan that only projects a 2% cut, not 32. But what is the right response to climate change? Even accepting that the problem is real, doesn't automatically produce a solution. So we will get two views now on the Trump climate policies and some alternatives from Andrew Revkin, strategic advisor for environmental and science journalism for the National Geographic Society. You may have known his work as a longtime New York Times environment correspondent, and he's the author recently, he was here for a book interview, of Weather, an Illustrated History from Cloud Atlases to Climate Change, which came out this year, and Orrin Cass, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and the author of the forthcoming book, and he'll be here next week for a book interview, The Once and Future Worker, A Vision for the Renewal of Work in America. So Andrew and Orrin, thanks for doing this. Welcome back, both of you, to WNYC.
Great to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Orrin, to start off and familiarize yourself to our listeners, you've written that a strong scientific consensus does exist, you as the conservative in this conversation, that human activity is producing climate change, but the actual impacts on humanity and the planet are much more in doubt, you say. How much do you still believe that after the new UN report?
Well, I still believe that completely. I think, you know, as you said, I think a lot of the science on climate is very good. I don't have any patience for how Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders talks about it. But I think it's important when we hear really big numbers to put them in context. And so when you mentioned in the report, you know, $54 trillion of cost, it's important to understand that what they're talking about there is what's called the net present value of all the costs for the rest of the century, so for more than 80 years. If you look at what they say the cost would be in 2100, they say their best guess is roughly 5% of global gross domestic product. And on the one hand, that's an enormous amount of money. I don't want to minimize that there are very real and serious costs here. On the other hand, we expect the world to be about six times wealthier at the end of the century than it is now. And if that's right, if we can continue with economic growth, then the climate effects are essentially a drop in the bucket from that perspective. You're talking about the difference between how wealthy we might be in 2100 versus maybe 2103 or 2104.
And I know you've written against what you call catastrophizing global warming, referring to things like those Democratic politician clips that we played, which I pulled those clips because you included them in one of your articles, with words like destruction of the earth and uninhabitable. How much would you say the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is, you know, 90 scientists from 40 countries, and their report that just came out, which they say is not political, and they include a range of scientific uncertainties, but still concludes that this is serious business with inundation of coasts and more droughts and more poverty. Is this catastrophizing to you, or do you accept it as science?
No, I think the IPCC reports are usually actually quite good and do a nice job of describing what's actually happening. I think the problem comes when it gets decoded or encoded, in a sense, by politicians and by the media. And so if I might pick on you for a moment, when you just described what the IPCC said as more poverty, you know, the IPCC certainly doesn't say there's going to be more poverty in the future than there is today. And that's a crucial distinction, that climate change is going to make things worse than they might otherwise have been. If we could choose, I think we should choose a world with no climate change, absolutely. But it is not forecasting a world worse than today, especially in human terms, in terms of how, you know, for some environmental issues it could. But in terms of human terms, for what it means for our prosperity, for the health of our societies, the report simply does not say that things are going to be worse than today. In fact, virtually every estimate and forecast and economic analysis I'm aware of says things will be much better in the future than they are today. It's just they might not be as much better as they would be in a world without climate change.
Andrew Revkin, do you want to jump in here?
Oh, sure. This is my 30th year on this, as you know. I actually was reporting on this first when the IPCC was launched in 1988, when Jim Henson, the NASA scientist, gave his first forecasts.
That was like the first big global warming moment.
Yeah, and I showed
media.
You. Yeah, and then that's when I did my first. It's this month. Now, radio listeners can't see it, but you can see it. My first cover story on global warming was 1988. And it had cigarette ads on the back in a science magazine, which gets to some of these issues about the slow nature of how we confront big changes. I guess that I agree that most of the press, most of the coverage, most of the rhetoric we hear on this issue is hyperinflated. It's distilled. The IPCC reports through this last 25 years have been increasingly firm about a human imprint on the climate that will last for millennia, actually. And that's the issue. I think the reason there's an over-distillation, especially in politics, is because we have misperceived what this is. It's an emergent property of civilization, essentially. You know, for 200 years, we've built the modern world on fossil fuels. It's still 85% of the global energy mix, and it's predicted to be about the same in 2030, with or without warnings from the IPCC. And how do you deal with that politically then? Well, always you pick the aspects of it that suit your politics. If you're on the left, you go back to the old great laws of the 70s and you litigate.
The environmental laws.
Yeah, Clean Air Act, that's, you know, being applied to CO2, carbon dioxide, the bubbles in beer. That's a tough sell. You know, the Supreme Court said yes in 2007, including with Scalia, et cetera. But it's not the ideal tool for the job. My big failure as a journalist on this for the first at least 18 years of my writing, till about 2006, was I was perceiving it still as a pollution problem, which led to a certain prejudgment on what the solution is. Well, laws and treaties, right? We did it with ozone, CFCs, we had a treaty, we had the Clean Air Act reauthorized, et cetera. And lately, I've shifted to covering it more as two problems. And when you do that, the rhetoric, what Oren said, and he's really deeply dug in on this, and I appreciate his writing a lot. But I still have yet to see folks on the conservative side actually come out with an agenda for how do you reduce global vulnerability. And you're right, the global economy is doing great. As Bill Gates and the World in Data, go to that website, the World in Data out of Oxford, I believe, charts all the progress we're making on infectious disease and, you know, poverty. But we're adding about 2 billion people by 2050, and they're mostly going to be in places that are really vulnerable to climate hazards. And in the meantime, here in the West, in rich countries, we've built enormous vulnerability. It's a terrible thing. When President Trump goes to the panhandle, I think on Monday, he'll see these, as the newscast just said, it's like a lunar landscape. But if you look on Google Earth at Mexico Beach, and you'll see it's this little sliver.
Where Hurricane Michael just hit.
Right, that was ground zero. And it was devastating, and it's devastating for anyone who lives there. I covered a similar hurricane, Ivan, in 2004. What I saw was so mind-blowing in Alabama, people standing by their devastated homes, going, and they weren't like freaking out and crying. They were going, oh, we're going to get our checks and build back bigger. And that's, the Times just ran this huge, wonderful package by John Schwartz and Kevin Sack on FEMA and flood insurance. And that's an issue actually where libertarians and liberals can agree and did agree once. So there are actual things to do about vulnerability and energy.
I'm a little surprised you brought up a particular storm, the one of this week. I did read that one way that this particular storm can be linked to global warming potentially is that the waters in that part of the Gulf of Mexico are warmer than they have been in the past because of global warming, and therefore the hurricane was able to build more strength than it has in that section of America in the past, and therefore it was the strongest hurricane ever to hit the panhandle of Florida. Are you drawing that connection?
But it's a fallacy. It isn't the strongest hurricane ever to hit that part of the panhandle.
Measured in certain ways,
in the last 160 years.
Wind, I think.
No, in any way. It's just because the record goes back to 160 years.
Uh-huh.
When you deal with a rare thing, these high-potency hurricanes, if you're not looking on a longer time scale, you'll miss how to characterize the rarity of that thing. Mm-hmm. I wrote a lot for the Times about this wacky field called paleotempestology. I love that word. You dig down in the mud behind, like in Jamaica Bay. I was out there in 2001, or right there on the panhandle. Scientists have done this. You'll see centuries of mud accumulating, you know, in these backwaters. And then you'll see a layer of sand. And that layer of sand is a hurricane as potent as Michael. And there's a guy from Louisiana State who just sent me an email a couple of days ago saying, there's nothing remarkable about this hurricane if you're, unless you're only looking at the last 100 years, 160 years. I haven't had time to write about this yet. My new job is more.
But then, and what do you want to be when you grow up? I want to be a paleotempestologist.
Don't you?
But
someone needs to do that.
But then why did you bring up Michael in relation to global warming?
Because the vulnerability reduction is an implicit imperative, setting aside the climate problem. And that's what people miss. If you make it all about climate change, you could have a big fight about attributing how much of Hurricane Michael to CO2-driven warming of the atmosphere and how much to attribute to just natural variability. And that's a complete dodge or distraction from the built vulnerability that we've done everywhere in floodplains, wildfire zones. When I was at ProPublica, I did a piece kind of integrating a lot of that. And if anyone wants to learn more, just Google for the hashtag expanding bullseye. There's a couple of geographers who mapped this, and it's very sobering. And again, you think about the politics. This is where I think Orrin and or anyone on the Republican side who wants to have constructive discussion about reducing vulnerability in a time of changing climates and surging coastal development, there's lots of stuff to do. And it was done once, too.
So let me go back to Orrin on that point. And Listeners, if you're just joining us in our 30 Issues in 30 Days series tied into the midterm elections, we're talking about Trump policy on climate and in the context of the new IPCC report on climate with Andrew Refkin, who's just speaking from the National Geographic Society, and Orrin Kass from the Manhattan Institute with two views. Orrin, the IPCC report said to meet the necessary carbon reductions to stave off these dire effects, as they see it, of warming, coal as an energy source would have to drop from producing nearly 40% of the world's energy to no more than 1-7%. Donald Trump, of course, is the more coal president. I read that coal produces about a third of our energy today. You'll tell me if that's right, but the IPCC wants it to go down, I guess globally, to 1-7%. Can I get your take on what current Trump policy is toward coal and what you think it should be in light of the climate science that you accept? Andrew just kind of laid down a challenge for conservatives to come up with alternative climate solutions to the liberal ones, but that really address the issue.
Well, I think we have to distinguish between two kind of modes of thinking about dealing with climate change, and that's the words we use are mitigation and adaptation. And mitigation really refers to reducing emissions to prevent the climate change from happening. Adaptation refers to a lot of the things Andrew just described in terms of making sure that we reduce our vulnerability so that whatever climate change occurs is not too disruptive. And so I think, you know, I actually agree very much with Andrew that adaptation approach and saying we need to reduce our vulnerability, first of all, regardless of climate change, and second of all, especially in the face of climate change, is exactly right. And I'd be happy to come back in a minute to talking about, I agree completely, conservatives should have more to say about that. That's an important conservative approach to policy, again, regardless of climate change, and especially given climate change. What the IPCC is calling for, and what you just asked about with respect to coal, is mitigation. And that's where we run into a very serious economic problem, which is that the vast majority of emissions and emissions increases are already coming and will, especially in the future, come from the developing world. And so one of the challenges the Obama administration faced, one of the challenges anyone faces in trying to actually prevent climate change from happening, is that, in a sense, it's not up to us. And I mean, as American policymakers, and while it feels good to say, well, we're going to switch, you know, we're going to use less coal in America, it's a little bit like saying, well, you know, people in Africa are starving, so eat your vegetables. It feels like there should be a nexus there, but the policies we choose here don't have as much influence as we might like them to on what the world does.
But let me jump in on that with a follow-up question, Orrin, because I think one of the things that Trump objected to most about the Paris Climate Treaty was that the U.S. and other developed countries were going to give a lot of money, cash, to developing countries with the intent that they don't have to just go for the cheapest, most polluting energy sources to kind of subsidize their emerging economies so that they can emerge with renewables, which we didn't do. We have to make a transition to renewables. If they can emerge with renewables, then it addresses what you're talking about, that a lot of the future emissions will be from developing countries. But Trump just saw that as a money grab by the developing countries, a way to get money out of, you know, rich daddy America, and he rejected it on that basis. So did Paris not make sense to you in that way?
Well, I think Trump is exactly right about that. Paris was effectively a shakedown, and the way that you can understand that is just by looking at what developing countries pledged to do. So developing countries pledged that, in particular in return for all this money, that it was never clear where it was going to come from or how, they were going to try to follow some emissions trajectory. If you look at what emissions trajectory they pledged to follow, it was essentially exactly the emissions trajectory they were on anyway. So China pledged to continue growing their emissions until 2025 to 2030, roughly the exact path we thought they were already on. India actually pledged to becoming energy efficient less quickly than it had already becoming energy efficient. You can go right down the line. And that's one of the reasons why when people evaluated what Paris would actually accomplish if everyone complied, it turned out to be worth almost nothing in climate terms.
Let me get Andrew on this.
Yeah, the failure of this argument lies in the whole history of climate diplomacy. It started out, remember, when I was back in the world, everyone was thinking about this as a pollution problem, top-down rules and regulations. And it was actually the Bush administration, and I never wrote this story for the Times, and I should have. They need more credit for shifting the conversation to two things. This kind of nudge approach, where it's less, you know, enforced action and more countries bringing forward things they can do in their domestic policy. And also major economies, where small clusters of countries, the big emitters, would get together involuntarily and push on energy innovation together, whether it's on nuclear power or on advancing new renewables or grid design. And that was actually embraced by Obama and built on. And when I look back in 1991, like before the Rio Treaty that this whole process emerged from, these two economists, Thomas Schelling, not some firebrand enviro, a Nobel Prize winning economist, he wrote that soft diplomacy is the only way to tackle a global complicated issue where you have uncertainty. And this term soft diplomacy is something people could Google for. And so the Paris Agreement,
where's the leverage in that soft diplomacy?
It's in creating a set of rules not for controlling the thing, but for just talking to each other. And we're in a world where there's more and more capacity to ground truth what people are or are not doing. China's getting more honest in its emissions estimates these days, not because the government or black helicopters have told it to. It's because there are now satellite images, and National Geographic is working on this global view of the world with others, with Google, and that gives you know which power plants are on or off.
Right.
You know
it's,
which ones.
It's harder to hide.
So we're in a soft world, and that can be good, but just bailing out is like, doesn't really capture the point.
I want to get to one last thing before we run out of time, and good talk. I appreciate both of you. Oren, you brought this up before, that one of your areas of emphasis is that we can focus government policy as much on adapting to warmer temperatures as turning the economy upside down to prevent them. So give us a very short take, because we are going to run out of time, on how much you see that as the ideal or even a potential for that strategy. Are you saying, yeah, go for it, more coal, go, bring back that coal economy, but there are adaptation strategies to a warmer world that we're not talking about in the media or in policy?
Well, I don't think coal is coming back because natural gas is cheaper and better in all sorts of ways in most cases here in the U.S. In terms of where policy should be focused, I think some of it is on some of the things we talked about earlier in terms of the way that we do flood insurance, the way that we do bailouts after natural disasters. We shouldn't be encouraging and subsidizing the building of vulnerable infrastructure in places where it's going to get wrecked over and over again. You know, we actually did flood insurance reform last decade, and as soon as it actually started to bite and coastal property owners saw what was going to happen to their rates, phones rang off the hook in Congress, and it got reversed. Those conversations are harder than kind of signing treaties in Paris, but they're actually going to make a lot more difference, especially in the U.S., for how climate change plays out. I think we should also be forward-looking in where we do infrastructure going forward. I think one thing the Trump administration has been very wrong about here and that I've criticized them for is they didn't just unwind some of these kind of, you know, clean power plan, big reg things that didn't make a lot of sense. They also repealed the President Obama's executive order on adaptation and planning. And if the Trump administration thinks they have a better approach, that's fine. But it's inexcusable to not have an approach to adaptation and planning. When we decide where our military bases are, where we're going to build highways, all of these kinds of things should absolutely be taking into account both just reducing our vulnerability in general and then accounting for any havoc that climate change might cause.
Who do you think, in literally 15 seconds, Oren, who do you feel like you're most trying to protect by fighting against liberal solutions to climate change? Who's vulnerable if the solutions go forward that they endorse?
Oh, well, here in the U.S., it's our industrial economy. I think when you drive up the costs of energy, when you impose regulations and restrict the construction of industrial facilities, you drive investment and employment away from those areas, and those are things we need more of in this country right now, not less.
Thank you. So, Andrew, last minute on that and on adaptation, build away from the coasts, other things, rather than turning the economy upside down to prevent more warming?
It's an imperative, as I said, with or without global warming. We're building vulnerability. But the thing that Oren has left out is a forward-looking strategy for energy. We're in an age of fossil abundance. I've written a ton about the future of natural gas. There's huge amounts. So if, given the multi-millennial timescale of the global warming problem, if we're not boosting science, basic R&D, which cuts the cost of alternatives that many Republicans embrace too, then we're facing a world with centuries and actually millennia of change. The House Science and Technology Committee, if anyone doesn't think the midterms matter, if you care about science, think about how much time they spent investigating climate scientists that could have been spent on, hey, what do we do? How can we use science better to make a world that's sustainable going forward to the next several centuries?
Andrew Revkin, Strategic Advisor for Environmental and Science Journalism for the National Geographic Society and author of the book that just came out this year, Weather, an Illustrated History from Cloud Atlases to Climate Change. And Oren Kass, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and author of the forthcoming book, and he'll be here it's either a few days or a few weeks, but you'll know him when he shows up, of the book, The Once and Future Worker, A Vision for the Renewal of Work in America. Thank you both so much.
You're welcome. Great to be here.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And that concludes the 10 debates on Trump policy as part of our 30 Issues Fall Election Series. Coming up on Monday, we'll start a stretch of 10 conversations about what Democrats propose as alternatives, starting Monday with immigration. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come right now.